Good evening, Larry.
Well, hello, Andy.
I think this call should be about interstate compacts. And I thought that it would be good for us to talk about how people can get themselves transferred from one state to another and the challenges that you've seen with people doing so. I guess we could cover something about the history of where it comes from and anything of the rules that may have changed recently and how people can get approved or they won't be approved in getting themselves transferred.
And how many hours do you have allocated for this?
We have all of them.
All of them. All right. Well, this is actually a topic that I enjoy talking about because I provide assistance in my state for attorneys in terms of training and resources on the interstate compact. There are a number of interstate compacts, and we're going to be talking about as it relates to offenders. But it'd be helpful to know what a compact is. And when you hear the term compact, what you're hearing is a treaty between the states is what a compact is. So we don't have treaties between states. We have treaties between nations, but we have agreements between the states, and those are referred to as compacts. So there is a compact agreement between the states regarding the movement of offenders who have been convicted of crimes against those states. It has nothing to do with federal probation, but these are agreements related to movement of offenders across state lines.
Can we just zoom out one step and talk about this agreement between states? I think before my whole adventure started, I just kind of looked at all 50 states as being kind of co-equal. You could just move around. There wasn't really any sort of delineation. But somehow, I guess when you end up under the guise of the legal system, now you're, I guess, kind of like property and you have to get yourself transferred from one place to another.
Well, that would be correct for most of the 20th century. If I'm the predecessor to the agreement that's enforced today, we have the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision. But the predecessor to that, I believe, was enacted in 35 or 37, was the Interstate Compact for Probation and Parole, the ICPP. And prior to that, there was not a lot of structure of people moving across state lines. So, in fact, states encouraged their offenders to leave the territory as one solution to the problem. But as you can imagine, that created problems for the other state because Greyhound therapy, as it was known, if you force the offender to leave one state and we won't bother you anymore, and that offender has issues that need to be dealt with or that are simply being handled by a Greyhound bus. If you leave our territory, it's not public policy for the other states. So the states decided in the 1930s that this is not an acceptable drafted that original document, the Interstate Compact for Probation and Parole. And then in the early 2000s, that was replaced with the current ICAOS that I mentioned, the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision. So to answer your question about you have a right of movement, you have much far fewer rights of movement in terms of going to another state because remember during the time that after a person has been convicted of a crime until they've served their sentence in its entirety, there's punishment occurring. It'd be nice if there were rehabilitation occurring, but there's a significant part of that being that the offender is being punished. So the state does, in fact, own that person to a degree until that punishment and that debt has been paid in full.
But I can guarantee you that someone listening to this is going to say, but this is America. I can do what I want. I can travel.
Well, that person would be misguided if they said that because while they're on probation or parole or any type of structured monitoring as a result of a conviction until that has totaled out, they have great restrictions in terms of their traveling. In some instances, they're not even allowed to leave their county. So they would be mistaken if they thought they could move to another state without anyone's permission. They could do it, but there would likely be consequences for having done that without permission once they ceased reporting into the state that had originally sentenced.
when I started doing research on this, probably around 2010 or so, I don't even know that all 50 states were on board at the time.
I believe they had all ratified and passed enabling statutes. What each state does when there's a compact agreement proposed, the legislative body in each state enacts a law which enacts that same language. And I'm pretty sure that they all had by 2010. I can't say 100% certainty, but I believe all states were operating under the compact by that time.
All right. It seems like I remember it not being that way, but I was looking for a handful of states, mostly on the eastern side of the country, and all of the states that I was looking for were in it. So all the states, and then it is covered by three territories, which would be the District of Columbia, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and Puerto Rico. So in all of those cases, you would have to get some form of permission, which we'll get into, but you would have to get permission. You would have to tell your probation officer that you're trying to move, and they would do all the paperwork. It wouldn't be on you to do, the offender.
That is correct. When you hear about a transfer, think in terms of a sending state and a receiving state. And the sending state, of course, is the state of origin for where the offense occurred. The sending state has to initiate the process. The offender cannot. So the offender only can advise their supervising authority that they would like to move to another state, and at that point it moves to a process. It was used to be all done on paper. They would fill out forms that are uniform, ICAOS forms, and those would be transmitted through the old-fashioned mail system. But nowadays, for the last several years, it's all done electronically. So they transmit online forms to the receiving state. And that begins the process. And then there are time frames for the receiving state to respond. So offender A in the state of Alabama would like to move to the state of Wyoming. So the Alabama authorities begin the process, and they ship it electronically to Wyoming with all the pertinent information about the offender and where the offender proposes to live and reside. And the Wyoming authorities have 45 business days to validate that address exists, and to give an affirmative yes or no whether that offender can be granted what we refer to as reporting instructions. And then there are expedited reporting instructions where some cases are mandatory that they give the instructions right then, which we can get into later. But in a normal transfer, there's a process which can take a couple of months from beginning to end before there's a confirmation that offender has been approved and to whom they should report to.
I don't remember where I learned this, but it is my understanding that it is a 45-day, it is a hard limit from the time that the paperwork goes in to the time that you'll get an answer. That's the maximum amount of time it can take, is 45 days.
That is what the rules in the interstate compact say. It would be difficult for me to say that is always met, because
sure,
a lot of things are in rules and then there's no consequences for not following them.
Yep.
I can assure you that there's no rule that says if the state doesn't respond within 45 days, it's a default acceptance.
Right.
I would imagine what would happen in a case where they didn't respond would be that the sending state would query them and say, have you made a decision yet? We would like to know where this application stands.
Right. Sure. That makes sense too. I just, in my personal experience, my transfer was denied at 43 or 44 days. So, you know, as it got closer, I was like, well, it's got to come in any day now.
And it did.
Yep. It sure did. So as far as, you know, you have varying degrees of, we'll just use residency restrictions, I guess, is kind of like the big deal. One state might have a 300-foot or another state has no restrictions. So how does that work when you move from one state to another as far as the restrictions that might be applied?
Well, that's actually a great question, because it's very confusing for the offender and for the supervising authorities. Keep in mind that these compact agreements are not front and center on a field officer's desk. So when they're supervising someone, they know that there's an interstate component, but they don't have the guidelines, which is referred to as the bench book. That's not sitting front and center on their desk. So So there's some confusion, but what the answer to it is, it depends on which rules they are. If, to simplify it, the rules that were imposed by the sentencing state or the sending state, those automatically go with you. If they were imposed by the court as a result of a judicial process, those go with you. The statutory requirements that are outside the court order, for example, if there are registration requirements that are in the state of your current residence, those don't go with you, because those are statutory requirements that are collateral consequences. So the registration requirements will be what they are in the receiving state, but the punishment conditions all go with you. And then once the person gets to the receiving state pursuant to the compact, they are allowed to impose additional special conditions. They cannot lengthen the sentence. They cannot do anything that alters how quickly the person gets off supervision, but they can alter the terms of supervision. So you might have came from a state where there was no curfew, and you may go to a state where there is a curfew. The receiving state has broad discretion to impose conditions that are consistent with what they would have imposed for that type of an offender had they been sentenced there. So that gets a little bit blurry, because you don't supposed to be imposing conditions offenders to transfer. So you're not supposed to be inventing special conditions. But if they're normal special conditions, if all defenders that have a sex offense of above a certain severity level, had they been convicted in that state of Wyoming, if they were going to be supervised with a curfew, that would be perfectly okay to impose that condition on that Alabama offender who did not have that when he left Alabama. And the same thing goes about residency restrictions. The Alabama offender, which is not a good example because they have some horrendous restrictions in Alabama in terms of where people can live. But if you took a state that had virtually no restrictions of where someone could reside, and they went to a state that did, as long as those are being imposed by the state as a registry condition, remember the registry conditions are what the receiving state requires. So you could have had a 10-year registration requirement in Vermont, and you could go to a state that has a lifetime. Too bad, so sad. Vermont is no longer in control of your registration obligations. You gave that up when you left Vermont.
Right, but you could become, I think Alabama's got 2,500 feet. You could go from Alabama.
Alabama has, yes. You could reverse that, and you could improve your lot in life. If that 2,500 feet was only because of the registration, but if it were imposed in the sentencing process as a condition of your supervision, it would follow you to the receiving state. And then there's an exception in the compact for conditions that the state cannot impose or cannot enforce. And they can notify a sending state that we will not or cannot enforce that condition here. And then it goes back to the sending state to determine if they will remove or lift that condition. And I use examples when this comes up about technology as it's evolved in the last 10, 15 years. There were states that were leading edge of the technological revolution with electronic monitoring. There were states that did not have it. So you would have offenders that a court in Georgia would say, you'll be subject to GPS monitoring. And they would get to Arkansas, and Arkansas would say, well, we don't have that here. So they would notify Georgia that we cannot and will not enforce that condition. And then Georgia would have to remove it, or else the transfer would be declined.
That made my head swirl, because it feels like you flipped a few things in the way that I understand it, as far as the, I think specifically residency restrictions. That's probably the biggest deal that would get transferred for a person. So let's say you're coming from a state like Alabama. Can you go into more detail about how that residency restriction could be imposed upon you in that state to where it would or it would not transfer?
It would have to be judicially imposed. If it's merely a part of the registration statute in Alabama, Wyoming has no interest in Alabama's registration statute. But if it's been imposed as a condition of supervision, Wyoming has an obligation to try to enforce that condition or state to Alabama that they cannot or will not. So conditions follow you that are imposed as a result of your crime, but the registry is a totally separate animal. So if these are imposed by the state of Alabama as a part of your registration requirements, they don't follow you, because if Alabama's charging you $500 a year to register your car, and Wyoming only charges you $30 a year because they're enriched with petroleum resources, they no longer care what Alabama required. When you get your car and register in Wyoming, you're subject to Wyoming's registration requirements, and it's $30 a year. Well, the same thing goes with registry requirements. They do not follow you. Only conditions of supervision follow you.
But the way that I understand even like the residency restrictions, that's not a condition of supervision, is it?
It can be. Okay. It can be. So it seldom is, but it can be. And that's the situation where they would follow you, which is what I thought the question was. But in normal circumstances, residency restrictions don't follow you unless they were judicially imposed.
Okay.
So if you had a particularized finding by a sentencing judge that offender could not live near a school, and they put that in the sentencing order, that this offender shall not live within 1,000 feet of a school or a playground or blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And that was in the sentencing order, that would follow you.
Right. Okay. That is how I'm understanding it. I guess it's just the way that you're phrasing it with the different places of where the authority would come from kind of threw me. But that's how I understood it. So I follow you. So you could come from a state that has, from when you got sentenced, it says you can't live near a church, school, daycare, whatever. You go to a state that doesn't have those, they're going to then say, well, sorry, you're coming from someplace that does have it, so we're going to apply it to you. That's got to be crazy complicated.
That's not exactly what I'm saying.
I thought that's what it was.
But that's not exactly what I'm saying.
Okay.
They're just because they're coming from a state that has it, that's not what the supervising authorities are supposed to say. They're supposed to say, this is in your court order, and
yeah,
we are obligated to enforce your court order. Mm-hmm. We are agents of your state. So the judge says that he wants you to be in at 9 o'clock. That's our obligation to have you in at 9 o'clock. But if that's merely a Georgia probation department requirement that was not imposed, if Georgia doesn't impose that in their sentencing order, it gets a little tricky. But things that are a part of the registry statute that are not in your conditions of sentencing, those don't follow you. When they're looking at conditions of supervision, they're not analyzing the registry requirements to see if those, because those don't transfer. So I hope we're on the same page here.
I think so. I don't know. I feel like we're not. I think I understand it. So a curfew, in my experience, isn't something that gets court imposed. I know that they do, but it seems like it would be rare to have a curfew imposed by the court. That would be a probation thing. Your residency
Correct.
Restrictions, your 1,000 foot, 2,500 feet, those things are going to be at the state level and follow you for the term that you are on the registry.
Provided you remain in that state.
Okay. And then, now you're throwing that monkey wrench in there again. If you then move to a state that doesn't have residency restrictions, those would follow you because they were imposed as part of your sentence from the court.
If they were imposed by the court, and they seldom are, but if they were, they would follow you. If it was merely Florida's law or Alabama's law,
yeah,
as a part of the registry scheme,
yeah,
they would not follow you.
Okay. Oh, okay. I think I follow you. So to flip the other part of that over, so you then go to a state while you're still on probation, you came from someplace that didn't have a curfew, and then you go to someplace that says, hey, well, these other people like that, they have a 5 o'clock at night curfew. It sucks to be you, you've got a 5 o'clock curfew.
That is correct.
Right. Okay. It's interesting. I'm going to have to think about how that got worded and see how that applies. All right.
Well,
so
it has to be a condition that they would routinely impose on a similarly convicted offender.
Right.
They can't do it to thwart the spirit of the compact.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. They can't target you is where you're going, I think, is another way to word that.
That is correct. They can't say, well, gee, we'd rather not have these kind here, so we'll add a whole bunch of special conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So he won't want to be here. But they can say, gee, now that you want to come here, we got to be open with you. we have curfews here,
right,
and they'll be applied to you because that's what we do routinely for people that have this type of offense.
Right.
And of course, you always have the option of not going.
Yeah, of course, of course. So let's go into, do you have a right to travel?
While you're paying your debt to society, you have no right to travel.
No right to travel. Where does that go into life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?
Well, you forfeit that right when you're being punished. Probation is an alternative to more serious punishment, which would be behind bars and on a compound. And there's very few rights to travel for a prisoner. So you're a prisoner outside the walls. And as a result of being in this condition of having restricted rights, travel is one of the rights you do not enjoy while you're being punished. Now, as a practical matter, there are processes for people to travel. They have travel permits that are issued through the Interstate Compact. So travel is routinely granted. And depending on the type of offense and the offender's record, it is fairly common, but there's no such right to assert. You can't report to your probation officer and say, go see my long lost relative in Wyoming, cut me a travel permit. I'll be here to pick it up tomorrow morning. Doesn't work like that. You have to ask for permission, and they have to deem that that's something that they're willing to let you do based on their criteria. And then they can initiate that process of issuing a travel permit, but you must be authorized to travel.
And they are not obligated to let you go.
As far as just for traveling.
Yeah.
And within the compact, there are some transfer cases that we could talk about. But in terms of just as a part of your supervision to be allowed to travel, there's no such right that can be asserted.
Even if somebody has some crazy amount of time of supervision, 20 years, I don't know. I don't know what the longest amount of probation that somebody might get. But multi-teens are in the 20s of years. And the whole time, it could be that they are stuck in their county or at least within the borders of their state. Could be.
Could be, and it frequently happens in my state that we have indeterminate supervision periods. And they range from five that people are not allowed to leave their county of supervision here without permission. And frequently, the permission is granted for county to county travel by verbal permission, but to travel out of state, it's extremely restricted, and there's people that are stuck. Now, what the probation authorities here will do is they'll invite people to go to court and get a court order saying that they can travel, and then they have that in the file, and they allow the person to travel pursuant to a judicial order. But as far as just asserting a right to travel, there's no right.
There is something from the United Nations. There, I forget what it's called. What is it called? It is called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Exactly.
Human Rights. Yes.
And there's I realize that this is probably, a non-binding thing. This is just like their position, their wish list maybe. And one of the things on there says that you have a right to travel and you have a right to leave your state, or excuse me, you have a right to leave your nation and return to it.
And the United States is a signatory to that declaration.
Okay.
The United States would assert that they're in full compliance because the United States government position is that they do not in any way interfere with a person's right to travel. There again, while you're under supervision, you have no such right.
Okay.
So the U.S. government would tell you that anytime anybody wants to leave the United States, that as far as they're concerned, it's good riddance. And that there's no walls, and that there's no detention here for people who want to leave. And the U.S. would also say that anytime a U.S. citizen wants to return or a permanent resident, that they can return unimpeded. Now, having not traveled a lot internationally, I don't know how much impediments are erected as far as return. I know there's just some clearances that people go through and declarations they have to make and some scrutiny they undergo. But as far as I know, no one has been locked out of the United States after they've traveled internationally that they had a legitimate claim, except for the brief time that Trump was locking people out right after he was sworn in as president. And that collapsed with a judicial order.
I have heard of some people of U.S. citizens. I have heard some people of Middle Eastern descent and coming back in through Canada and having a terrible, terrible time. More of along the lines of, I guess I heard it directly. I heard like a radio cast and they interviewed the individual. It's kind of off topic, but so I think it has happened. And, you know, I don't know what the extenuating circumstances were as far as if the person was on some sort of terror watch list or what. But yeah, I think coming back in might be hard for certain kinds of people. So can a court mandate that someone is transferred from one state to another?
I'm not aware of any such judicial authority, and this is part of the, what comes up in my training sessions. The courts can do nothing more than authorize a transfer because there, again, the processes are mandated by the compact that have to be followed. So the court issues orders commonly telling the, what it essentially does is it tells the sending state, don't interfere, go initiate the process. So, but that's the limitation of the order, because if a person's sentenced in a court and the probation department wants to be cantankerous and not submit the application, there's no way the offender can do it. But if the court orders that the person be transferred, the order ends after they've gone down to their local supervising office and initiated that application. And if the process takes place and the receiving state doesn't approve it, they're back to where they started. So there is a workaround for that, and I've had to stress there is a workaround. If a court is determined that it wants a person to be in another state, all it has to do is to remove all reporting requirements from the probation and make it unsupervised, and then that state has no more authority over it, because in order for the compact to be triggered, there has to be a reporting requirement contained in the person's punishment. So you can give a person 3 years of punishment with no reporting requirements, and voila, the interstate compact is no longer a factor.
And for, I'm probably going to word this horribly, but for all practical purposes, a judge in state A has no authority over somebody in state B. Is that worded fairly?
That is worded very fairly. The judge in Alabama has no authority over Wyoming. His or her authority would end at as long as the people in Alabama had initiated the process. He could hold a show cause hearing and say, did you send the application through the processes? And they would say, yes, we did, Your Honor. And well, then why wasn't he approved? Well, that's up to Wyoming.
Right.
And so the judge is powerless after the application's been submitted.
I just wanted to make sure, because going back to what I started with originally about my understanding of how the states were. I mean, we're kind of like 50 individual countries. We have a federal umbrella, but each one of the states has their own laws and rules, and we coordinate together. We agree upon a bunch of things, but otherwise we are practically 50 independent nations.
You are correct. We're 50 separate sovereigns. And one more point to add about that last point about the judge. It is critical, the wording of that order, because what with lack of clarity with those judicial orders, sometimes the authorities in the sending state will not issue and initiate the transfer process because it'll say that transfer is authorized. And I stress to the attorneys that I train, that's not the language you're looking for. The language you're looking for is that the probation authorities in whatever state A is are ordered to initiate the process, not it's authorized, because a cantankerous supervising authorities will say, well, the judge doesn't tell us what to do. It just simply says that the transfer to Wyoming is authorized. That's fine. Doesn't say we're ordered to do it. It says it's authorized. So that wording is very important, that it be clear that the court wants them to initiate the process, that's what they're ordered to do.
Yeah, the way that you're wording that sounds like an issue that you and I are working on in my state. Just, you know, it's a different situation and kind of going in the opposite direction, but it sounds kind of similar. Does the Interstate Compact only apply to registrants?
Oh, no. The Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision applies to, as long as they have either a felony conviction or some misdemeanor convictions, and they have more than 90 days remaining on supervision. And I'm a little unclear about the 90 days, because is it 90 days from when the application is received and decided? Suppose that that Alabama sends it with 91 days left. And if Wyoming has 45 days, they send it the response back on the 44th day. They no longer have 90 days left.
Yeah.
But that is the wording of the compact.
Yeah, that says the applicant has three months or more remaining on supervision. Yeah, it doesn't specify from the time that it's submitted or from the time that it is approved or denied, whatever. Yeah, that could probably get hairy for somebody. And shoot, if you're trying to transfer that close to the end, unless you have some sort of serious extenuating circumstances, like a job offer or something like that, just ride it out. Just wait. Do you happen to have an idea how many transfers are dealing with registrants per year?
I don't know that number, and I don't know how that number would be obtained. I know that there's a significant number of them that do apply and seek to transfer because of the difficulty. Anybody who's trying to live on the outside finds the employability, particularly within in harsh environments in the southeastern United States and even some states outside that, with harsh requirements about driver's license branding. They look to go to other states, and they initiate a lot of transfer requests. A significant number of them are not approved because, for some unknown reason, the receiving state doesn't want to import sexual offenders from another state. So a lot of them are turned down for some very slim and flimsy reasons. But there are a lot of applications.
Hmm. I think I read that there's somewhere around 7% of the transfers are for registrants.
Well, that's a significant jump, because there's hundreds of thousands that move across state lines over the course of a year.
Sure.
I don't know that number either, but it's a large number. I know New Mexico, my state, there are thousands that they process through the Interstate Compact Office.
Do you want to talk about the various conditions that must be met for a person to be approved? I guess this would go under the mandatory approval category.
Well, I think we could cover that slide with some without great detail, but the 90 days, 3 months or more of remaining supervision and being in compliance with a plan of supervision, and having connections and established family and support structure or some sponsor in the state that you desire to go to, is very helpful for moving across state lines. But there are cases, there are some disagreement about what cases must be approved. There's some where there's a mandatory acceptance where the state doesn't get a choice, and there's some where it's discretionary. And the mandatory acceptance cases are like military transfers. If one can imagine being in military and having a felony conviction and not being discharged, but those are mandatory cases. There are some mandatory requirements on people who were living in the receiving state at the time they were sentenced. So those people are mandatory acceptance cases, and they have a little bit easier road to hoe, unless of course they're a sex offender. And then there's a special rule for sex offense transfers that puts additional stipulations. And we can go into that rule a little bit, because I stress it a lot in my training for attorneys, is that you get a great plea offer for a person who's got an interstate component to their offense. And the most common would be the solicitation type offenses, where people are in chat rooms thinking they're talking to minors and they're talking to law enforcement. And they drive across a state line of a neighboring state, and then they get arrested by the police. And that case gets worked out where there's a probated sentence if it's a first-time offender. And then they want to return to the state where they were from, where their house is, where their job is. And they're not allowed to, because there's a separate process for sexual offenders. And what determines if you're a sex offender is if you have to register in either of the states, if the state that sentenced you, it requires registration, or if the state you're going to be living in requires registration, then you're a sexual offender and they can't let you return home. So you can end up trapped in a state where you just did a plea thinking you were going to drive back across state lines that night, and you can have a need for 45 days worth of housing to see if the state will let you return home. And then the sad thing is that oftentimes the address where the person was living doesn't qualify, and the counsel, the defense counsel, didn't even go into that with the person, saying, before we do this plea, we need to make sure, best we can figure out, if you're going to be allowed to live in your current residence. If not, I need to buy you some more good place to live that will meet the requirements. So that's a biggie for people who were pleading out sexual offenses across state lines.
There's a movie called Terminal with Tom Hanks, and he's like from Estonia or something like that, and he travels maybe to the United States. And while he's in the plane, his country goes into chaos and they overthrow the government and, you know, civil war breaks out. And when he lands, he no longer has a country and he's just stuck in the terminal. He can't get into the country. He's, you know, he can't get into the United States because his passport is no longer valid. And he can't go home because it's no longer a country. So now the guy's stateless.
Wow.
And, you know, I mean, obviously it's a fictional story, but it's probably based to some degree on something that happened or an exaggeration of something that was close to happening. But couldn't a person trying to do an ICOTS transfer almost end up in that situation where they get their approval to go and they've packed up their U-Haul and they're on their way, they've signed out from state A and they get to state B and state B says, nope, not here. And now they can't go home because they are no longer a resident of where they came from and they can't stay where they went.
Well, I've not heard of that particular scenario happening after they've been approved for going. I've heard of the previous scenario of after they've done their plea, they can't go home and the attorney didn't prepare them for that scenario. But there's one provision in the Interstate Compact: you can always return to your sentencing state. So you don't need, I laughed on one of the listservs I'm a member of, a person was really proud of themselves because they had helped their loved one get transferred to another state and then transferred back. And I thought, well, you can kind of be proud of getting them transferred to another state, but there's nothing to be proud of transferring back because you always have the right to come back. Now, having said that, you may come back and want to live at a place that they won't approve. And they may tell you, sorry, you have to go to the halfway house. You have to go under a bridge. You may have to do this or that because we can't let you live there. But you have the right to come back to that state that sentenced you. So that scenario shouldn't happen that you described for a person to be stuck between states.
So when a person gets transferred to another state, what rights do they have in the destination state? Do things dramatically change as far as their situation?
Well, they do actually, Andy, pick up some rights that they're not aware of, and a lot of attorneys are not aware of those rights that they do pick up when they go to the state. There's some negativity in terms of the state can apply additional special conditions, but in terms of them being violated, in my state, for example, probation officers can arrest people on an arrest and hold, and so they can do the same thing for an interstate compact offender. But what the big right that they acquire is that they can't be forced back to the sending state without due process. And the due process is a probable cause determination that a significant violation has occurred of probation. And that is clearly in the interstate compact rules in the bench book, but no one seems to know how to effectuate those hearings. But in 1972, the United States Supreme Court ruled in two separate cases, and I can never keep which one was separate, was probation and one was for parole, but there was Gagnon versus Scarpelli, and there was Morrissey versus Brewer. And they determined that an offender being supervised in another state before they are hauled across the country in some cases, sometimes the state's not right next door, before they're hauled across the country, that they have the right for a preliminary due process probable cause determination to be made in that state. So that by U.S. Supreme Court precedent and by interstate compact rules, there's a right to a probable cause determination. But I hear horror stories about offender after offender who's gotten arrested on a PV, a probation violation, and they're presented with a waiver of extradition. Mm-hmm. And they go ahead and sign that waiver. So they're in California. Next thing you know, after they've ridden the extradition bus for 4 or 5 days, they find themselves in New Hampshire and they're having a revocation hearing And they might could have never had to go to New Hampshire if they had asserted their right to a probable cause hearing and not signed that waiver of extradition. So that's a big significant right that people are not aware of, attorneys are not aware of, and the machinery in place is not in place to enforce that right. And so people languish in jail because they're arrested and a state doesn't have a case on them, and they're languishing in jail. And finally, they complain to someone, a jail official, who brings it to the attention of the local court. And they say, well, he can waive extradition if he wants to. And they set up an extradition proceeding, which is extradition demands. And the sad thing about it is in an extradition proceeding, you have far fewer rights than you do under the interstate compact. For the interstate compact, before they can force you to be returned to a state, they have to find probable cause that there's been a violation of supervision, and it has to be a significant violation that would result in a request for revocation had that violation occurred in the receiving state by an offender who was convicted in the receiving state. So that's a pretty significant threshold in an extradition hearing. The only issue in contention is identity. So if you consent to be adjudicated through an extradition proceeding, the judge is only inquiring about identity. Are you the person that needs to go back to whatever state? And it's unfortunate. People sign these all the time, and they find themselves back in their state of sentencing, subject to sanctions that they might could have avoided by having a due process probable cause hearing. So I hope that's not too long of an answer, but it's a significant thing to me that I will really stress about because it's not being followed.
Okay. No, I'm perfectly happy with a long answer. Just that, so I'm in some destination state. I've transferred to wherever. And I do something, I think the way that you're describing it, I haven't done something like I drank a beer. You're talking something a little bit more significant than that.
Well, violations of supervision can be as simple as drinking a beer. And those technical violations, they have to be treated with the appropriate level of seriousness by the receiving and the sending state. But the question for the receiving state is, what would we do if one of our offenders drank a beer? That's the way they're supposed to handle it. They're supposed to send an ICOTS notice to the receiving state and say, offender A was drinking a beer. He tested positive for whatever that blowing instrument they have the people do, the breathalyzer, and we have done X to him. And that's it. Now, if the receiving state automatically seeks revocation for that, if that's their policy, how they would treat a person who got caught drinking a beer, then that's what they can do. They can say, this is of such severity that we are encouraging you to take him back, and we're going to initiate the retaking. And it's called a retaking, whether the state is pushing them back or if the state is that they came from is pulling them back. It's a retaking procedure either way. But in order to push an offender out, you need three significant violations, and that's the push out. The pullback only needs one, because if the receiving state is notified of a violation, and they view that to be a significant violation at any time, they can say we want to take this before a judge. But if the receiving state wants to push you out, they need three significant violations that would result in a revocation had they occurred in that state, and then they can push that offender back. But they still need to do the probable cause hearing. They need to find that those three violations occurred, that they are significant, and they need to report that to the sending state and say, we've held a probable cause hearing. This offender we found probable cause for these three violations. Had he done these three violations here, we would be in court or before the board seeking revocation of his supervision.
Well,
and the sending state is supposed to take that with significant seriousness.
Okay. Here's what I would
like your question.
What I'm actually trying to do is, so we have 20,000 people listening to this podcast, and it would seem probable that someone is going to transfer and someone is going to have a revocation. And I want to set up not legal advice because we're not attorneys, but some strategies for them to follow when they do end up in a position of being revocated and they are presented with that form that says, hey, you're signing your waiver, you're getting extradited back home. That you mentioned significant, so you're in your new state, you've transferred, and you do something that would cause the state that you have now moved to they're going to call where you came from. So they're going to call back to the origination state, and they're going to see how they would handle this particular thing. And if they say we would violate him for that, then how would that go? So they have said, yes, we would revocate him. Now you go for the good cause hearing, and it could still be turned down by the judge?
So in the scenario I think you're describing, if the receiving state were to notify a sending state of a violation, because they're obligated to notify them of violations. So that's a given. But they also, the form contains a recommendation of action, and they are also allowed to go ahead and initiate administrative actions their own. They can do their in-house sanctions. So they can treat you as if you were sentenced in that state in terms of if any imposition of sanctions that they would do to an offender. They could extend your curfew or do something like that. But if the notice gets to the sending state, and they say, oh my God, he did that, they can always direct the sending state to take you into custody. They can follow their process of getting an arrest warrant issued for you, and they can have you returned to face the judge. You don't get a free ride because you're out of state, that the receiving state gets to determine when you see a judge, if that sending state wants you to see the judge. You agree that you'll come see that judge whenever that judge wants to see you, and they'll bring you to see him or her if they need to. So the sending state could initiate a return of you simply because they found what you did to be a significant violation, and they want you to be in front of a court. But if the sending state wants to force their hand, that's a forcible retaking, and they need three significant violations. And significant is by the standard of, had those occurred on an offender that was sentenced in that state, they would view those with such a gravity that they would be seeking a revocation. So what's significant on a push out is what the severity of the receiving state. What's significant on a pullback is what the sending state decides that they don't want to tolerate. And when they're notified that you did something that they find intolerable, that you need to see a judge, they can force that to happen.
I also want to clarify a little bit in the relationship between the sending and receiving state. It almost sounds like you're describing it as you're still on probation in the state that you came from. You're just there's sort of like an agreement that the receiving state is going to supervise you sort of as a courtesy, as an extension of the sending state, and they still have the power over you to return you as if you were Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz and bring you back home.
That is a good way to put it, because the receiving state is acting as agents for the sending state. You're still on probation, you're still on parole, whatever type of an offender. The older compact had a separate category for probationers and parolees, and this compact merged the types of supervision, so it refers to offenders. But you are at the mercy of the state that you committed the offense in, and the jurisdiction for sanctions ultimately rests with them. They could a state could force you back with three significant violations, and you could get to the sending state, and they could say, we don't see this as enough to warrant revocation, and they could remit you to supervision. Where it gets a little bit iffy is because they can't force that state to take you back again. So you're back on probation, but then you've got to find out if that state will take you back, because you've been returned. You're no longer a resident there.
Right.
So it gets a little bit tricky of going back, and probably don't want you if they forced you out.
But let's just, so, you know, all the 50 states, they have, some are more lenient than other ones. So you could come from a lenient state and go to a more strict state, and they could say, hey, you jaywalked three times, we've had enough of you. They kick you out and they send you back to where you came from, which is a lenient state. And the lenient state says, yeah, we don't really care, but they kicked you out. We can't make them take you, and we're not really going to do anything to you, but you're not going back to where you just came from either. Is that a far-fetched scenario?
Well, I would take a little issue with the jaywalking, have to be violations that would rise to a level where revocation would be sought on one of their in-state offenders. So I don't know of any states that would seek a revocation on jaywalking. So that's probably an extreme example.
Yeah.
But you, in terms of a more realistic example, yes, it could be that a court would not want to revoke based on that. And there are examples where before the evolution of such tight restrictions on terms of what people can view, there were judges who took the view that sex offenders under supervision would actually in fact have sexual urges, and that they would want to be stimulated, and that they might look at a movie or they might look at a magazine for older people. And so there were states who took the therapist line that any stimulation is bad. So they've got these conditions that you can't have any material that causes arousal. And there were judges across the country, I haven't heard of any recently, that would say, no, we're not going to revoke a person for having a Penthouse magazine. Those are legal. They sell them in the stores and they're adult nudity, and we're not going to do that. But through the evolution of the treatment providers, they've convinced them now that this is so serious because it starts them down the slippery slope. If they're looking at stimuli, that's the first step to the next step to the next step. So more and more judges are actually revoking based on that stuff, but there was a time when they found that to be ridiculous.
Right.
So that would be an example of something where you could go to a state that was using that model of supervision, and they could go back and the judge say, I don't want to hear that kind of stuff here. I've got real important things to deal with, not someone looking at a Penthouse magazine.
Right. I think, I use extreme examples just to try and to throw a point out. But so, yeah, you come from a very, very conservative kind of state where, you know, any sort of adult kind of content might be against your treatment, but you come from a very liberal state, and like, yeah, whatever. Okay. And to that point though, I was, not long ago, I was asking somebody if they were watching Game of Thrones, and he said, I can't watch that.
I don't even know what Game of Thrones is, but what would be the problem with watching that?
Well, everyone out there listening is shaking their heads that you don't know what Game of Thrones is, but Game of Thrones is, according to like downloading news, it is the most downloaded TV show ever. It's an HBO thing. The first season, it was there was just a boatload of sex throughout the first season. There's killing, there's cussing, there's debauchery, there's whorehouses. The list just goes on. But it is an amazing show, high production, multi-million dollar episodes, etc. And it is pretty much all the rave, and everyone is talking about it. We are now coming up on the last season sometime in 2018, I guess it is. It was a book written by, Martin. R.R. Martin? God, I'm going to get flamed. They're really, really well-written books. Kind of like dragon time frame, medieval time frame, knights and horses and cavalries and all that stuff. It's a really, really excellent show. But like I said, the first season was just laden with sex. So I asked this individual if he was watching Game of Thrones, because I know he likes that kind of material of medieval Dungeons and Dragons and stuff. And he goes, I can't watch it. It's my treatment provider said it's not something I can watch.
So, for the listeners, I'm not a TV watcher. So I would explain if it's on TV, I wouldn't know about it. So
George R.R. Martin is the author's name. It just came to me. But anyway, we're back to that kind of some form of content, but it's the way you were just describing it is so years ago, a decade ago, whatever, that might not have been construed as being something awful. Whereas now it is that you're talking about the slippery slope, like, hey, you start with maybe Maxim magazine and that leads you into something harder. Now you're looking at Playboy. Next thing you do, you're doing Hustler. Next thing you do, you're looking at porn on the internet.
That is a theory. I've not seen the evidence of that linkage, and I don't believe that it can be substantiated. But there's an amazing thing about America, and that's that the capitalism excels at creating a demand for its services.
Mm-hmm.
So all this stuff feeds into the team containment model where we have probation authorities working in conjunction with treatment authorities, working in conjunction with law enforcement, and they have ways of creating demand for each of their services, because the sex offender tracking unit needs to be justifying its existence, so it can be continually funded, so it has a need to justify even though it's publicly funded. The treatment providers need a continuous flow of cases. The polygraphers need a continuous flow of examinations to do. So this vicious cycle of when they think up new things to require of a person, that creates more violations, which creates more of a demand, and it's a vicious cycle. I mean, if you just said anything that's lawful possessed, that you shall not be able to possess that while under supervision, well, that would be one thing that most people could understand. But that wasn't far enough, because with just that restriction, you couldn't come in people's houses and search them and bust them and write up big reports and violate them and give them extra treatment and do an extra polygraph to find out if they're following these conditions. So it's a vicious cycle where, like I said, capitalism is quite creative at creating a demand for it. And that's what they've done. This has become a very big industry.
The Sex and Fedner Industrial Complex.
It's almost to that point, the President Eisenhower, except he talked about the military industrial complex. But we have an industry that has sprung up around so-called treatment, which I have very little faith in the treatment. I'm a believer in treatment.
Sure.
If it's treatment that's actually treatment that is designed to help people. So I'm not poo-pooing treatment. I'm poo-pooing these models where there's no confidentiality, that you sign a disclosure, that the probation people can be told everything you say. I mean, think about how silly that is. What would be the likelihood that anything substantive would be disclosed in treatment when it was immediately going to be disclosed to your probation officer,
mm-hmm.
which would result in possible further action and tightening the screws and possibly a revocation if you happen to admit something that was in a gray area? I mean, the whole thing is absurd, but that's what we have.
It is. I've witnessed it firsthand.
So it kind of got off the interstate compact, but these issues affect interstate offenders because, as you pointed out, if they go from a state that's halfway reasonable to a state that's not halfway reasonable, these things that they never expected can come into play. And typically, I find that there is an ideology in play of conservatism, but in some cases, this stuff doesn't even fall on ideological lines.
Right.
You have states that are supposedly progressive that are enlightened, and they're also imposing some of this absurd stuff. So mm-hmm. so you can't just follow ideological boundaries on this because it doesn't flow.
Right.
So, and conversely, some of the judges that said, no, I'm not going to revoke these people were known to be very conservative, no-nonsense judges. So I've seen it both ways. But generally speaking, as far as the punishment that's imposed typically tends to be harder in the southern states and the more conservative states. The sentences tend to be longer. The tolerance tends to be less as a general rule.
Sure, sure.
So the interstate compact, though, is very confusing. The rules are sometimes not completely clear, as I mentioned earlier, about the 90 days. And the training is not adequate on in any aspect of it, be the field officers, the court officials, or the offenders themselves. Of course, they shouldn't be trained in it. But if you're going to be on interstate supervision, it would behoove a person to go to the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision if they're allowed internet access and to become familiar with a lot of these rules and processes.
And Larry, I really only have one other question, and it's, so the person has been moved on to, they have transferred to this new state, and they do something that they have done some sort of violation. And how do they then get the train to stop, and where they're putting this paper in front of them to sign a waiver to be extradited? How do they get that to stop if they have this right to have a probable cause hearing?
That is a very good question, and we're working on trying to figure that out here in my state, because you find oftentimes there's an offender sitting in a detention facility where, when they're locally detained, their process is in place for the public defender will be visiting with them. They have like a local case number, and those usually don't fall through the cracks. But we have a person here. If they're in a state where the PO has arrest and hold powers, so they're arrested pursuant to that authority, and then there is no local case number, so they're sitting in detention. Well, it's ambiguous. It's difficult enough if they have resources financially and they have an attorney. So, in a case where they had resources, what they would do, we would recommend if it happened here, would be that they contact an attorney. And they would file a notice and demand for a probable cause hearing in the local court. And that would trigger something. And then the question becomes, how do you file that? Because you file things in court with active case numbers. So most jurisdictions have miscellaneous case numbering systems where you can initiate a miscellaneous action. So you would file that notice of a demand for a probable cause hearing and serve that on the supervising authorities and perhaps their in-house counsel. And once they're aware that you know you have that right, there's a good chance that something will happen. If you don't have financial resources and you're languishing in jail, it becomes more problematic because if you call the public defender's office, they're going to say, "Well, what's your name again? And what's your case? We don't have a case on you."
Right.
And trying to get an overworked, understaffed public defender's office to try to deal with a case that doesn't exist is going to be a very difficult challenge. So I don't have a complete answer for that other than saying that someone is going to have to be very persistent. And even if they have to do something as creative as filing what Clarence Gideon did in the case in the 1960s, where he had a right to counsel, and he filed his a handwritten petition to U.S. Supreme Court, which would never fly today, but they may have to resort to drafting up a notice of demand and underline it and put that in underlines and mail it to a local court and hope that somebody doesn't shred it when it gets there. But it's an unanswered, unresolved issue about how to assert and get these probable cause hearings to be held. And I don't have a complete answer.
So in the crime shows where I know my rights and I demand that I see a lawyer, whatever, you're not describing that the person has that level of, I don't know, what's the word? They don't have that level of standing, maybe is the right way to word that?
Well, it becomes when you're watching a crime show, you're usually watching a person that's not been convicted.
Yeah, sure.
And you have the, of course, the right to remain silent. Of course, the Supreme Court's been chipping away at that. That's a topic for another show. Mm-hmm. But you have the right to remain silent, and you have the right to have an attorney and have one appointed for you if you can't afford one. But in this case, the criminal proceeding is over with, and you're simply serving your sentence. So trying to assert that right is a little bit more difficult because they're not really wanting to interrogate you. they're trying to bust you out.
Yeah.
So it's a problem. It's a significant problem, and I wish that the advocacies like the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and organizations that have greater resources would at least have this come up on the radar screen once in a while. And at least in our state association, we are talking about this problem and trying to figure out how to address it. But it's a significant problem that doesn't have an easy answer.
I'm looking for the answer that says, like in the movie Beetlejuice, if you say that three times, then Beetlejuice actually shows up. So mm-hmm. while you're sitting there and they have this waiver in front of you and your back's to the wall, you can't, there's not some sort of magic Fifth Amendment kind of thing that you can say that will stop all the trains and go, oh, okay, that's what you're talking about.
Well, you can refuse to sign the waiver, but that becomes one of the unfortunate collateral consequences of being in custody. The longer you sit in custody in a system that's not designed to have a process for you, and they bring that waiver to you and they sweet talk you and say, well, you know, if you sign this thing, you can be back in Alabama and see the judge, and who knows, the judge may not do nothing but throw this thing out.
Right, right.
And that becomes very tempting. Because local jails are not routinely places that people enjoy staying in. I've heard about these country club facilities, but I've never seen anyone pull up to a door wanting to pay dues to any of them.
Certainly.
So local detention facilities can be very horrible.
Yes.
Places where there's violence.
Yep.
And there's lack of proper medical care, ventilation,
food,
and food is a given. That's one of the things you think that they would provide. But if you were in Joe Arpaio's jail, you got the spoiled food, but local detention can be very harsh, and there's only so much a person can take before they begin to crack, and before they tend to throw in the towel, and they know that when they get back to where they came from, they know that it's going to be possibly better. And certainly can't be any worse in some instances. We've got some jails in my state that you certainly wouldn't want to be in.
No, certainly.
I mean, they're that bad as far as danger and the mm-hmm. the dilapidated conditions. And so it's a tough position.
We're going to have to talk about Arpaio at some point.
So I like talking about Sheriff Joe.
Good man. Good man. Do you have anything else?
The president thought he was good enough for a pardon.
And he took care of that for us.
So
do you have anything else? I think we should wrap this up. We've been at this for a while.
I think we've covered this quite well, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the Interstate Compact, and we'll do it again if you have more questions.
I will definitely have them. Larry, this is episode number 3. I'm quite excited. Thank you for another really good conversation, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye. Have a question? Send an email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com or leave a message at 747-227-4477. You can also leave comments on the website, registrymatters.co. This is episode 3. If you like the show, please share it with someone. We would really appreciate it if you did. Thanks for listening.